Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts of the George Washington University, sitting in today for Diane Rehm while she's recovering from a voice treatment. When four former guards for U.S. security firm Blackwater were convicted of the fatal 2007 shootings of Iraqi civilians, it renewed questions about outsourcing wartime responsibilities. Now one former military contractor says we are on a dangerous path towards increased reliance on private-run warfare. Sean McFate is the author of the new book. It's entitled The Modern Mercenary, Private Armies and What They Mean for the World Order. And Sean McFate's with me in the studio. Welcome. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Robert.
And you can join us, as always, 1-800-433-8850, drshow at wamu.org. And I'm very interested, Sean, to start with your own background, because you served in the military and then left specifically to become a contractor, and there were interesting reasons for it. Tell our listeners why you did it.
Sure. I was a paratrooper in the 82nd Airborne Division for most of my time, 8 years in active duty service. And I left, ironically, in 2000, thinking the future was nothing but peacekeeping. and then a couple years later, I ended up working for a large private security company called DynCorp International, mostly in Africa.
And what were your motives? I mean, you talk about the life as a military contractor a lot freer in some ways.
Yes, I mean, curiously, despite the myths, there are not a lot of salary bonuses. In fact, there's some financial reasons why you should not want to become a contractor. But one of the reasons I wanted to is you have some control over your deployments. Like if you were on your third deployment, you could say, no, I don't want to, I'll sit this one out. I have a family to attend to. So you have some control of your destiny. And also you could do interesting things that you really couldn't do as a young, say, officer in the U.S. Army. You had opportunities to be sort of entrepreneurial in how you found solutions to complex problems.
What would be a good example of something you ran into like that?
Well, one of the tasks we did is we were hired to raise a new army for the country of Liberia. And the army still stands today, I'm proud to say, and it's a contractor-built army completely. There is no U.S. or U.N. forces involved in creating it. That's not something – we were able to use techniques that others brought in from the United Nations, from other countries. We didn't have to stick to the U.S. playbook, and arguably that's what helped its success.
You also mentioned very briefly in the book that you were detached to help protect the president of Burundi during a highly tumultuous period in that Central African country, and that you did successfully save him from an assassination attempt, but you don't say in the book what happened. Tell us.
Well, I can only tell limited bits and pieces of that. And it wasn't me. It was a team of different people. But basically in 2004, the U.S. had information that the president of Burundi, which is a very small country in the middle of Africa in a very troubled area, was targeted for assassination by extremists, basically. And that had he been killed or assassinated, it would have re-triggered the Rwanda genocide, which is the neighbor of Burundi. And the question is, how could the U.S. Prevent this from happening without having, frankly, U.S. fingerprints all over it? They opted to go contracting route, and I was sent in there with a small team of people, and we, working with Burundians, kept him alive.
And why no fingerprints? I mean, this is part of a larger question, which is what has led to the growth, the enormous growth of this industry. But why in that case, to give us an example, why was it in the U.S. interest not to have their fingerprints on that mission?
Well, I can only speculate, but there's a lot of advantages, depending on how you look on it, about this industry. First of all, they're quite creative and clever and efficient in how they do work, but they also afford a modicum of plausible deniability for policymakers. So if something really goes bad, and this is a very high-risk operation, they don't have to have U.S. soldiers involved. They could say, well, it's contractors, they could deny it, or say, we didn't know what they did, et cetera.
Is this, to some extent, the ghost of Black Hawk Down, the tragic example of American soldiers being dragged through the streets of Somalia that had such a traumatic, in your book, you quote, One executive is saying that was the kind of incident that helped fuel the value of contractors.
Mm. Yeah, Africa, after the Black Hawk Down incident, became sort of a U.S. military no-go zone. They didn't want to get sucked into a conflict there. And so contractors became a very interesting and attractive option for policymakers.
On this question of growth, Sean McFeight, you point out that 10% of the military force World War II contractors, up to 50% in Iraq and Afghanistan. In addition to this notion of plausible deniability in some places, maneuverability in others, what has helped fuel the rise of this industry?
Well, in the United States, in the last decade of war, policymakers were left with a terrible choice in Iraq and Afghanistan, wars that went on much longer than they anticipated. And without getting to that discussion, they had three options. They could either withdraw early, which would have been politically untenable for both Republicans and Democrats. They could have instituted a national draft like Vietnam to fill the ranks of an all-volunteer military that needed spots to be filled. Or they could have used contractors. And they chose contractors because it was most politically viable.
You mentioned the possibility of a draft. Ever since Vietnam, that really is just totally off the table. And, of course, the ranks of the military have been filled by very brave and patriotic volunteers. But you're saying it wasn't enough?
It wasn't enough. Half of the armed forces that were in zones of conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan were contractors. And they weren't all American contractors. They were from all over the world. We think of these companies as American companies having American employees. Yes, they have American leadership, but most of their sort of lower ranks are from other countries.
You also write about one of the incentives here was that it's cheaper. You have the analogy of, well, it's the difference between renting a car and buying one, that it's like any outsourced service, that if you only pay for what you need.
Yeah. I mean, using contractors or mercenaries or whatever, it's always cheaper. They specialize in things. They have ways of, to doing things that are cheaper. And there was a government accountability office report that actually suggests that using a unit like Blackwater versus an infantry equivalent was much cheaper to use Blackwater in war. And, of course, in peace, it's even cheaper because you just dismiss the contract.
I'm talking to Sean McFeight. He's the author of The Modern Mercenary, Private Armies and What They Mean for World Order. We have some lines open, so anybody wants to call in and participate in this conversation, please do. 1-800-433-8850, as always, is our phone number, or send us an email if you have a question for Sean. When you talk about expertise, give us an example of the kind of expertise that a company would have that would be particularly useful for a government that maybe they don't have in their own forces, or at least find this option more attractive.
Sure. So, the U.S. government, the U.S. military is pretty supreme, does everything well. There's reasons, though, that the U.S. military still uses contractors. But a lot of other countries could find them very useful. They have special skills like language skills or intelligence or know-how. If you can imagine also, there was this one company in South Africa called Executive Outcomes in the 1990s, which was a real mercenary corporation that had, armed helicopters that could take over countries, and they tried to do that. The company, or Executive Outcomes, is now defunct, although their sort of alumni network in Africa is still is pretty active. So,
well, one of the things you just mentioned that I find interesting, I do know this, I've written about it, that the ability of American agencies, intelligence agencies, others, to recruit, say, folks from the Middle East who speak Arabic can often be very difficult to recruit these people, partly because they come from countries where people are very suspicious of intelligence agencies, partly because for security reasons, a lot of recruits are deemed unacceptable because they have relatives back home. And these language skills, Arabic, you might get some, but when you get to Pashto and Dari and some of the more important languages in that part of the world, hard to find. So part of what you're saying is you get around some of the government bureaucracy by using a contractor for something like this.
Right. I mean, the private sector is really good at cutting through red tape. And they can do things really efficiently. So for the same price of hiring like a U.S. infantry unit, for a fraction of the price, you can hire some other sort of logistical unit that could get things done more quickly. And they can also go to you know, vendors that the U.S. military might not even think of.
Also, you point out that it's not just the government that is fueling the rise of this industry. NGOs, corporations, big oil corporations, you mentioned ExxonMobil, also employers of these private armies.
Yeah, I mean, so the idea now is that this industry, which the U.S. has really kind of given the sort of leg up to in the last 10 years, is now looking for new clientele. After Iraq, much of this industry moved to Afghanistan, and now Afghanistan is sort of shutting down as a market with the U.S. They're going to other places. They're going to extractive industry like oil and gas and timber. They're helping humanitarian workers who want to protect their people and their facilities. It's possible someday that a very rich oligarch might hire one of these companies to do something that we might find to be unseemly.
One of the examples you give is the maritime industry protecting itself against piracy, that this has largely become an outsourced mission.
Yes. So there are companies like Saracen operating in Somalia, which was founded by one of the Executive Outcomes alumni, shall we say, and with some backing from Eric Prince, who was the founder of Blackwater.
Sean McFate, The Modern Mercenary is a book. I'm Steve Roberts sitting in for Diane. Give us a call and ask Sean some questions. We'll be right back, and so stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Staples, with copy and print solutions for small business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, and custom frame prints and posters. More at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen. And from Rhodes Scholar, with educational travel adventures to 150 countries, including Cuba, offering experiences for grandparents and grandchildren, active outdoor enthusiasts, and others. A catalog is available at roadscholar.org.
Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts sitting in today for Diane, and my guest this hour is Sean McFate, former American military officer, now author and scholar, teaches at the Defense University, and his new book is The Modern Mercenary, Private Armies and What They Mean for World Order. He spent a tour working for one of them, the Dyn Corporation in Central Africa. And Sean, we were talking about all the ways in which non-governments are using these mercenary armies, and we were started talking about protection against piracy, and whether it's in off the coast of the Horn of Africa, whether it's in the Straits of Aden. These ships laden often with very valuable cargo, particularly oil, very, very vulnerable. And this is one of the real growth areas of this industry.
Yeah, when we think about this industry, we think of it as a U.S.-only phenomenon. But now it's proliferated way beyond U.S. control. So you have shipping lines, you know, doing hiring counter-piracy, like private navies, basically, and also off the coast of Nigeria and the Gulf of Guinea. And what they do now is they have, like, big ships that are – you can't bring like armed guards into ports, but you can have a big ship sitting in the middle of the ocean full of armed guards and armory, and they fly or they move to a freighter, to an oil tanker, put their security on that tanker, they call it embarked security, and they then sail through troubled pirate waters. And then when they're done, they get back on their sort of home ship. And, you know, another thing that they're starting to do is they're starting to use drones. You know, and they can easily make those into armed kamikaze drones. We haven't seen that yet, but it seems to be likely. So you have private armies, you have private navies, now you have private air forces. We're starting to see, you know, we have private space flight that's not armed yet, and hopefully it will never be armed. And then lastly, you have cyber.
And you talk about something called hackbacking, which I found fascinating. And these are really private anti-cyber terrorism organizations. So describe them for our listeners.
So hackback companies are cyber mercenaries, basically. So just say you're a company. You're like, I'll make one up. You're a ABC company, and you get hacked by China, by the Russian mob, you don't know who. And legally in the United States of America, you can't – all you can do is play defense. You can't play offense. And you're tired of trying to play offense, trying to be a goalie all the time. And so what you do illegally is you hire what we call a hackback company. So if you get hacked, this company is a bunch of crack hackers, and they find out who hacked you, and then they hack them. Now, they can't probably – retrieve your data, but they can cause major damage to the hacker and hopefully act as a deterrent.
These you can hire companies to do this.
Yeah, there are hackback companies, not in the United States or not legally in the United States. But as we know about the internet and globally, we don't sort of a territoriality doesn't really matter that much.
You know, and another factor that you write about in the book, Sean, is the larger global picture. You talk about the growth of failed states create lawless areas, the rise of non-state actors. This is a much larger issue. The president talked about it last night in the State of the Union when he talked about asking for authority to battle ISIS. The news out of Yemen, a country that has been a breeding ground for terrorists and non-state actors. And part of what your thesis is that as the authority of states that were strong during the Cold War have eroded in the post-Cold War world, it's opened this world for the non-state actors, the ISISs and the Al-Qaeda in the Arab Peninsula, but also the need for these private contractors to answer this non-state threat.
Right. I mean, the bottom line is this. The world is growing increasingly insecure, and now these people are offering security. And conflict is becoming commoditized. So if you're, for example, an oil company in North Iraq, in Erbil, which is an oil area, that right now is kind of a land of private military contractors protecting oil facilities. And they're not like American companies. They're from all over the world. So we're seeing these companies fill in the security vacuum and making a profit on it.
Now, we mentioned in the opening the very recent judgment in the Blackwater case. Now, that's probably the best known. And, of course, they achieved such notoriety. They've changed their name twice since then, okay. not known as Blackwater anymore. But this jury verdict that convicted four of their employees of a massacre in Iraq, talk about the significance of that judgment, whether it's going to affect this business at all.
Well, it is significant, and some of the legal questions around the judgment will leave to lawyers. But, you know, it's an example of accountability. Some would say that these four individuals were convicted of murder, and that's the way it should be. They committed murder in Baghdad. Will it change this industry? I don't think so, because we have systemic problems, and convicting four individuals is not going to fix a systemic problem.
But you do talk about this question of accountability, and I've been talking about the downside of the rise of this industry. They're outside congressional hearings, which are mechanisms for accountability, outside the Geneva Convention. A mechanism for accountability. This is one of your big concerns, that there is not enough regulation or supervision or accountability.
Yeah, this is a very secretive industry. I mean, the CIA and the Department of Defense have more oversight on them than does this industry. Journalists and researchers can't even FOIA these companies.
Freedom of Information Act. Yeah.
That's right. And when researchers knock on their door, they typically say, you know, what we do is proprietary knowledge. You can't know anything about it. As a result, we don't really have good transparency as to what these companies do. We don't know who they hire. They don't, you know, any of that stuff.
Well, how were you able to gather information for the book? Obviously, you had some advantages because you had been part of this world and you had contacts. But did you run into a lot of these roadblocks?
I did, and the information in the book is all from open sources. And so I was very careful to make it open sources and not to, you know, seek proprietary knowledge and expose that.
Now, one of the things, it's kind of a nightmare scenario, but you do raise the question of, since these are businesses and they're out to make a profit and war is their business, I kept thinking as I was reading that the slogan from the Vietnam era that supposedly was scrawled on a wall, you know, war is our business and business is good. One of the risks here is almost, it's like a novel or a movie, but the notion that these companies might foment conflict in order to stir up business. Is that a real fear or just a nightmare idea?
You know, it's a very real concern. Mm-hmm. I mean, look, you go back to the European Middle Ages when contract warfare, which is like contract killing, was how things were done. I mean, most history, military history, is privatized. Out-of-work mercenaries become bandits, and they engage in racketeering. So, for example, in the Middle Ages, they come up to a walled city and say, "Look, give us 5,000 pounds of gold, and we won't sack you." You know, could that happen today? It's not going to happen to Washington, D.C., but could it happen to a small town in eastern Congo? Yeah, it could happen. So this is the issue.
Have you seen it happen yet?
We have not seen it happen yet. I think, though, that, you know, right now, in the last 10 years, the U.S. has been kind of a sugar daddy in this industry. There's not been any need. And I'm not talking about American companies. I'm talking about, you know, warlords in Afghanistan who then say, I'm not a private military company. And they sort of become predatory.
One of the things you do these days is teach American officers at the Defense University, if I'm correct.
Measure defense, yes.
And one of the things you mention is that professional military really despise this industry because they're drawn to this mission for patriotic reasons, family tradition, and that this, in a very evocative phrase, you say it, they feel that it erodes the warrior ethos. Talk about that.
Yeah, so I'm a professor at National Defense University as well as Georgetown, and I have many military students. This is like a war college, National Defense University, and they're senior military, and they almost universally disdain. And it's not just them. We also have international students from all sorts of countries, and they all disdain this. The same way in the Middle Ages, knights disdain mercenaries. It's because for American military officer to – we don't call it working for the military. We call it serving. You have a sacred bond with the government, bounded in patriotism and the ideal of democracy and the American way of life. And you take huge risks. You don't get paid much, and you have a lot of life hardship, but you do it for this idea of service. Mercenaries or military contractors take this and they turn it on its head and make it into a transaction. And this is an affront to the military profession.
And that leads into a tweet we've gotten from one of our listeners, Caroline, who asks, how does the use of mercenaries affect the emotional investment of citizens about going to war? We're so far removed from it already.
That's a great question. So one of the things that using this industry does, it creates a principal agent issue with, you know, those who are declaring to go to war aren't the ones who actually have skin in the game. And what it can do is creates moral hazard. It lowers the barriers to war. It's easier to say, yes, let's go to war if you don't actually have to go yourself. So one of the implications of this industry worldwide is that we'll see more war in the future, not just of big states, but also of little small ones too.
But I think also Caroline is, raising the question about sort of public opinion. We talked earlier about how the draft being a political impossibility at this stage in American life, and that because the volunteer army is professionalized, as you described, a lot of Americans have little or no contact with military officers, and there is this detachment that Caroline talks about, and what she is raising the question, it gets even more detached, and the separation between the citizen and those serving the country really the separation already great could get greater.
Right, yeah, it creates this idea that you know warfare is what other people do. Mm-hmm. We don't have to do that. And I wonder how that will change policy decisions in a democracy.
Caroline, very, very interesting tweet. We appreciate it. And here's an email from Wesley, who writes to us from Greensboro, North Carolina. He says, when I was in the military in the late 60s, soldiers did nearly everything. Could we have military running mess halls and hospitals with an all-volunteer army?
Well, curiously, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld in early 2000 said, no, we should not have, you know, privates running chow halls. We should have privates, you know, shooting terrorists. And let's contract these things. And that's actually how part of this got started. You know, the idea, though, of, you know, where are we going to create, you know, 50,000 more privates overnight without contracting them? We'd have to have a national draft. So, yes, we could do that, or we could shrink the army, or we could become isolationist. It's sort of our choices.
So not everybody, you know, just so we're clear here, you make the point in the book that not every contractor is an infantryman. That there are a lot of other services. I guess mess halls being a good example, as well as construction. I would imagine is another example of of an outsourced task that the military does, but also has others doing it.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, only about in Iraq, for example, only about 12 to 15% of the contractors were armed. The vast majority were just, you know, cooks or doing maintenance in trucks and just doing sort of general contract services. But the scary thing is that the armed ones can have an outsized impact. I mean, look at, you know, Blackwater at Nisour Square in Baghdad, where they killed 17 civilians, Iraqi civilians. I mean, that made the entire Middle East go aflame against with anti-U.S. sentiment. So just a handful of armed contractors can do a great deal of strategic damage.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. You also point out another question here, which is the casualties the contractors started to incur, that there have been well-known cases of contractors in Iraq being captured and assassinated. But you point out that it's sometimes hard to know because it's not necessarily good for business for the contractors to make it known the kind of casualties they're suffering.
Right. I mean, you know, these companies, private security companies, are sort of like banks who get hacked. I mean, they're not going to admit it to, if they can, get to the public. They're not going to admit how many people they're losing. And there's no rule requirement for them to do so. There's not a congressional committee saying how many of you lost. But from what we do know is that they've increasingly lost more and more over the last, you know, 10 years, where they're now where more contractors are dying than U.S. military soldiers.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's the if you look at the graphs from 2000 to 2012, you can see it's like they crisscross each other. In the beginning, it's mostly soldiers dying and very few contractors. Now it's kind of reversed.
Wow. Interesting. Does that hurt recruitment for them?
No, because what they do is they go to countries like, say, El Salvador to get people. I mean, they get ex-soldiers from all over the world who already live in dangerous places, and they get them on the cheap. You know, they don't. It's sort of like hiring somebody who makes shirts in America versus somebody who makes shirts in a developed world. It's cheap labor, and it's the same market dynamics apply for the market for force.
You mentioned former military, also. Police, I gather, are also a source of recruits.
Yes, a lot of former military, military and police are the primary.
Well, that gets into another question, which Kel writes to us. How does having private contractors who make six-figure salaries save government's money compared to what an enlisted Marine or Army person makes?
Well, if you're a contractor, and I'm speaking from experience, you make a higher salary than I was making as an officer in the U.S. Army. But I have fewer benefits, and I have no long-term stability. So I don't get a pension. After my contract is done, they can just let me go. So ultimately, I'm not sure who has long-term financial advantage. And that's just Americans. I mean, if you're like, again, say you're an El Salvador citizen who you're fighting for these companies for America in Iraq, it gets very complicated, I know. you know, you're making a lot of money compared to what the Salvador Army is going to pay you. So, they don't make a lot of money. I think in the early days of Iraq, there were a lot of rumors about that. And maybe that was the case back then, but today they don't.
But the companies are profitable. You point out that some of them are publicly traded and that many of them live in this sort of gray world of international global commerce where they're not really subject to much regulation anywhere.
I mean, yeah. I mean, these are not – I mean, I don't want to call these companies mercenary, but when we think of mercenaries, we think of like lone gunmen in the swamps of the Congo, right, in the 60s. These are like publicly traded multinational corporations, you know, bought and sold on Wall Street by venture capitalist firms. And they have sort of a, you know, corporate culture. If you go to their corporate offices, and then you get downrange, as they say, then you can see, well, these are not this is not FedEx of the battlefield, as one of them put it at one point.
But the analogy was interesting when he said, you know, we're the FedEx of the battlefield. He was trying to say we provide a service. We're very good at it. We have streamlined this service. We can do it more cheaply than anybody else. You hire us, and you're going to save money and get better service.
Yes. So the person who said this was Eric Prince, the founder of Blackwater. And in some ways, he's right. They can do the question of, you know, quality control. And there's a question of, like, well, what happens if they get a higher offer from someplace else? I don't think American private military or private security companies would switch to Russia because Putin is buying them out. But you can imagine, say, a Ugandan company doing that. So,
can you actually buy stock in some of these companies?
I believe
are any of them publicly traded?
Yeah, some are publicly traded. The ones who are publicly traded, this is not probably, in my opinion, their core offering. The ones that this is their core offering are, to my knowledge, not publicly traded.
Sean McFate, his book is The Modern Mercenary. We're going to be back with your phone calls, 1-800-433-8850. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane, and we're going to be right back, so stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years. From LegalZoom, for over 10 years providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. And from the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children, both in and out of school. More information is available at wallacefoundation.org.
I like solving problems, Commander. And Enigma is the most difficult problem in the world.
Benedict Cumberbatch earned an Oscar nomination for his performance in the film The Imitation Game. On the next Fresh Air, he talks about playing a mathematician recruited to break Nazi codes during World War II. Join us.
Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. My guest this hour is Sean McFate, former American military officer, paratrooper, then served a tour as a military contractor, now a university professor at Georgetown at the Defense University. And he's written a book, The Modern Mercenary, Private Armies and What They Mean for World Order. Sean, let me read you some emails. This from Sarah in New York is reflective of a lot of folks asking similar questions. Because contract armies only make money in times of war, military contract companies are incentivized by war. I worry that such companies will do whatever it takes within their capacity to ensure a constant state of war to maintain the need for their business, keep profits up.
Yeah, she's right. So this is the problem of linking profit with warfare and not creating like more F-16s as a product, but services, right? Companies are incentivized for profit to elongate and expand war. And then historically, again, looking back to the Middle Ages, out of work companies become predators. They become bandits. Or, you know, we think of Pirates of the Caribbean, you know, from the Disney movie. That's actually basically a true tale where privateers, which are like mercenaries of the sea, they were hired by England and Spain. When the war was over between England, Spain, and the Caribbean, they became pirates. This is the biggest problem. This is also why if a world with mercenaries in it, we'll have more war in it.
I was thinking as you were talking about the Taliban, now not quite the same thing, but a military group encouraged and supported for a certain purpose by the Americans, which was to fight the Russians in Afghanistan. And a few years later, they became our enemy using our weapons. So perhaps that's at least a tangential example of what you're talking about.
Well, it is. And we see this in Iraq, too, with the Sons of Iraq. These were Sunni militias, you know, in the 2007, 2008, 2009, Americans trained and equipped them, and now some of them are probably working with ISIS.
Here's a related email from Manuel in Norman, Oklahoma. What are the prospects of mercenaries fighting each other for opposing regimes or company? Are they already doing this?
It's very possible. We don't know right now when they're fighting each other, but it is in the future. On the trend line we're on right now, it seems likely. And is it possible that they could actually collaborate to elongate and expand the war? Yes. We have history as a guide mark here. And again, the European Middle Ages, where mercenaries are very common, we saw this happen.
You almost have to believe this is happening in Syria.
Yes, you do.
I mean, it's such an incredibly complex situation. But
yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, the Gulf states have long paid Sunni fighters to go to Syria to fight the Assad regime. Are they mercenaries? Arguably, they are. There's allegations and rumors that, you know, Putin is hiring Chechen mercenaries to fight in eastern Ukraine right now. We're seeing Abu Dhabi and other Gulf states hire fighters from Central America to go and protect their gas lines, oil lines around the Gulf. So this industry is taking off. I mean, 30 years ago, this would have been considered anathema. Today, it's considered normal.
Jim in Florida writes, for these private contractors, my question is this. Where do the rules come from? What international laws apply? What roles do the laws of contractors source country play, as well as the country in theater?
The answer is no one knows. There are no rules, really. 10 years of war in the Middle East, the U.S. chose or did not regulate this industry, and now the industry is global. There's no Geneva Convention. There's no real international law. There's something called the International Code of Conduct, where certain companies sign up and say, we promise not to do human rights violations, et cetera. But there's no enforcement mechanism. And for this to even work, the company's got to confess, like, oh, yeah, we killed, like, 3 children in Sudan yesterday. Punish us. No company is going to really want to do that.
And here's from Jay, write something that many of our listeners have asked about. What are the benefits for mercenaries? Hospitalization, life insurance for families left behind, something like veterans benefits, PTSD, or other illnesses that may develop years later?
There are no benefits for mercenaries. Unless they come from a country that has social services, there are none.
Here's another email from Travis. Says, contractors rob the brain trust from the uniformed services. As soon as I have a soldier trained and competent, they leave to take a contracting job. It negatively impacts our military capabilities.
That's true. And they call this the gun drain in the Department of Defense.
Huh.
An analogy might be, fair or unfair, is like you train a pilot in the U.S. Navy, and after so many years, he or she goes and you know, works for U.S. airlines. The idea is how much, you know, is the U.S. getting its benefit, its value out of the training it invests into our soldiers?
Let's turn, Sean McFate, to some of our callers. And we have Lance in Bradenton, Florida. Lance, you are on the Diane Rehm Show.
Yeah, hey, guys. I just wanted to refer back to your point of the three ways to put more troops into a war we might be involved in. The two that were politically on a tenor, which was the pull out or the draft. And, of course, the third was go to mercenaries. My thought was, can we stop being the police of the world for the most part and turn this over to the United Nations and exert some influence to have them go where we would like them to go? Instead of more Americans, we have more French and more Russians or whoever else might be involved with the United Nations to get boots on the ground instead of us.
Thank you, Lance. Of course, a lot of the United Nations forces are multinational already. In fact, very few Americans actually serve under the blue helmet. But answer, Lance.
Lance raises a great question. I mean, yes, the U.S., and many have argued this, should stop being the world police and work through multilateral, you know, organizations or just be less aggressive when they use contractors. And I wouldn't call them mercenaries right now. But the question is, you know, the bigger question is, will the UN start using this industry? And there have been some quietly who suggested this because there's more UN peacekeeping missions than the UN can possibly fill. Mm-hmm. And could mm-hmm. this industry, under certain circumstances of regulation, augment those and take the burden off of the U.S. and other countries as well?
Let's turn to Gerard in Traverse City, Michigan. Gerard, welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm a little concerned, and I would like your comment. Both Steve and Sean, during this program, you've used the terms extremists and non-state actors and terrorists to describe other people. But it seems like these private contractors, and often what the U.S. military itself does, is terrorism, extremism, and why don't we use those terms to describe what is happening here? Because we've seen, you know, in many cases where the government and private contractors have tried to go kill heads of states legally elected. And why don't we use the term terrorists and extremists instead of mercenaries and private contractors?
I'm a little uncertain about your comment. You mean in referring to Americans?
Yeah, I'm referring to these, let's say, Blackwater. They're terrorists. They're going in and they are in terrorist-type activities. Any way you slice it, these private contractors are doing things that could be described as terrorism, but the only reason we don't describe it as terrorism because they're from the West and they're, you know, they're okay. Under the sanction of the U.S. government. Why don't we use the...
Okay, we got your point. We appreciate your call. Sean?
So Gerard, you know, many in Iraq would consider Blackwater to be terrorists, for example. During the Nisour Square incident of 2007...
Describe what that incident happened.
Sorry. So in 2007, in September, a squad of sort of Blackwater private military contractors killed 17 innocent Iraqis at a traffic circle in Baghdad, and there really was nothing done to them. They were, you know, as later on, as Eric Prince, the founder of Blackwater, was asked in congressional testimony, what happens to contractors who kill people overseas? And he coyly answered, they get aisle or window. Meaning they just go home and nothing happens to them. You know, just only – that was several years ago, and they only just got convicted, you know, a few months ago. So really there's not much accountability, and to many in the Middle East, private military contractors are unaccountable armed people that are not much different than terrorists.
Let's turn to Clay in San Antonio, Texas. Clay, welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
I just wanted to make a comment. I feel that y'all are grouping state-sponsored militias and private security contractors too closely together, and it's not really separating what their functions are.
Well, stay on the line, and we'll get Sean to answer, and then we'll see if he satisfies your comment, Clay. Go ahead, Sean.
Well, in some ways, they are different. In other ways, they're very similar. And the ways that they're similar is that the U.S. government is paying – whether it's a multinational corporation or a tribal group of people, money to do military-like operations. In that way, they are sort of private force, and the militias don't really exactly answer to, at least in Iraq, they don't really answer to Baghdad. They're fairly independent. So there is some similarity there. They're not the same thing, as you point out.
One difference is you're talking about an indigenous group of local fighters as opposed to folks who might be imported from abroad. That might be one difference.
Yeah, exactly. So local militia groups are, you know, local, if you will, call patriots or Minuteman or whatever we want to call them. But they're indigenous to that region. Whereas private military companies they're expeditionary in nature, and their personnel are drawn from all over the world, and they are driven primarily, if not exclusively, by profit.
Clay, does that help? Do you have a follow-up question? Okay. Yeah. We'll go to another caller then. Let's go to George in Orlando, Florida. George, welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I have three questions. My first question is, do you believe that the utility of the service contractors will assist in fulfilling our nation's interest in keeping access to markets and resources in the world? And do you think in the near future, the service contractors from this country or any other country in the world could be used against to target our own military and political leaders?
Sean?
Well, answer your first question, your second question first. The way the U.S. has used these contractors so far is purely in a defensive role. So not to go and target political leaders or go and attack enemy bases, but just to defend things and let the U.S. military do the attacking.
Like what you did in Burundi to protect the president.
That's right. That's what I did in Burundi. Is, you know, so these companies do a couple things. They defend and they also raise military forces or security forces. That's kind of what they've done. They could do more in the future, and they may not be working for the U.S. government. So the question is, yes, they could do that, and it wouldn't be that big of a leap for them to do that. In terms of utility for achieving U.S. national interest, the answer is yes, they can. They can absolutely help. The question is also, is there indirect, you know, if the U.S. is using this industry, is it also legitimizing it? And is it also breeding it, where people who've worked for these companies now go home to another country and start their own small private military company? The answer is yes as well. So there are costs to using this tool.
Is there any mechanism for congressional oversight or accountability? Is there a budget line in the defense budget? Is there a place where you or any other scholar or investigative reporter can figure out the scope of this kind of investment?
No, it's really hard to find information about this industry. You have to go through the committees. So if it's a military contract, then you have to go through the Armed Services Committee on the Hill. You can't. There's no sort of committee for outsourcing war or something. you know, Henry Waxman, I'm sure, would have liked to have that. but there's it's very frustrating, and even members of Congress may not always have access to the contracts that they're writing the checks for.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We've got time for one or two more callers, Sean McFate, and let's see if we can call up here John in York, Pennsylvania. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show, John. John, you're on the Diane Rehm Show. Come on. All right. Let's go to Victor in Arlington, Virginia. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Fascinating show. I know you talked a little bit about how contractors are used more widely than in combat roles. And one thing we do know is that contractors here in the United States also serve in the U.S. intelligence community. And unfortunately, we've seen some incidents over the past year where that hasn't gone so well. You had the unfortunate Navy Yard shooting. And you had, of course, Edward Snowden's leaks to the media. I was wondering if you talk about, like, the implications of having someone who's not necessarily working for the U.S. government in that role, and what that means about where the ultimate loyalty may lie.
And you're talking about in the intelligence world.
That's right.
Okay, good. Very interesting question. Thanks. Go ahead.
So another interesting facet Victor's raised is that a lot of the intelligence community is also becoming more privatized. It's a couple differences. To do a lot of the analysis, they mostly do an analysis, and you have to have a security clearance, and you have to be an American citizen, and et cetera. Where they started to do interesting things in the last 10 years is also what they call collection. So there's allegations that Blackwater ran human intelligence networks in Iraq for the intelligence community, running spies, basically, which is, you know, outsourcing intelligence collection is difficult. There's a conflict of interest there that you don't have as with analysis. And then, of course, with analysis, you still have the issue of Snowden. You have somebody who could, you know, just sort of blow the entire lid off of the intelligence community and the U.S. Diplomacy just with a couple of keystrokes, and that's a big problem.
And does that raise, in your mind, the question of security, of one of the flaws of outsourcing, that someone like Snowden, not subject to the same loyalties, the same scrutiny, the same chain of command, or all sorts of things that were not there?
Yeah, I mean, it's been said before that democracy and secrets are not compatible. And this world is extremely secretive, not by design, but just by fact, the way it is. And that's of great concern to me.
We only have about a minute left, Sean McFaith, and give me your sense of where this is all going. You've drawn this picture of a growth industry, decline of state actors that has helped fuel us is only going to accelerate, as best we can tell, whether it's in Yemen or Syria. What's the outlook here for this industry?
Well, we're at a crossroad right now. The world is, not just the U.S. I mean, if left on autopilot, we will see eventually these private military firms turn into mercenaries who will work for anybody who pays for them, and we'll see it proliferate and grow and indigenize, and we'll have a free market for force that will create more war as we saw in the Middle Ages. Or we could try to shape this industry not through regulation, because they'll simply move offshore, but through creating market conditions to encourage best practices. And the U.S. and the U.N. and others have the opportunity to do so. The question is, will they?
Meaning what? Give me a specific example. When you say best practices, is this more oversight, more accountability? Transparency?
So, for example, just say the United Nations was going to use them to augment peacekeeping. They'd have very strict and public transparency measures, accountability, et cetera.
Okay. That's going to have to be the last word. Sean McFaith, his book, The Modern Mercenary Private Armies and What They Mean for World Order. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane Rehm, and we appreciate your spending an hour of your morning with us.